Let's play some cards.
From Harrah's St. Louis Casino and Hotel, this is The Final Table, starring professional poker player Dennis Phillips and Paul Harrah's.
Winner, winner, chicken dinner!
Wow, winning.
Now, from the Harrah's St. Louis Poker Room, here are Dennis and Paul on 590 The Fan, KFNS, and KFNS.com.
Coming up on the show today, Oral Hershiser, a recreational poker player who was in town last week to call the Cardinals World Series victory for ESPN Radio and play a little poker here in St. Louis as well. I talked to him last week. He will join us by phone in just a few minutes here to talk about both of those games here on The Final Table. Also on the show today, Ed Miller, the noted poker authority, who's got a new book out called Reading Hands in No Limit Hold'em. Terrific new book for, I think players at every level, but particularly for small stakes players. If you play 1-2, 1-3, 2-5, maybe even up to 5-10, there's some information in here that you need to include in your game, and Ed writes about it in a great way that'll make your reads at the table a lot easier. So that's coming up today. I am Paul Harrah's, sitting here at the feature table of the poker room of Harrah's St. Louis, where the Bad Beat jackpot is $93,000, while my partner Dennis Phillips is out of the hospital and back at his home in Las Vegas, Nevada. Hi, Dennis. How are you feeling?
Oh, much, much better. Hopefully I can make it through a full hour this time. Again, I apologize for leaving early last week. It just was getting to be a little too much.
Well, I don't think anybody blamed you 3 days after having your guts ripped out by the surgeons in northeast Indiana. And now post-emergency appendectomy, everything okay?
Yes, it is. I'm still very restricted. I haven't been able to drive yet. They've got me on a limitation. I mean, I can only pick up like 15 pounds, all sorts of little things like that. But slowly getting better. I'll be back at the table shortly.
Good.
No doubt about that.
Good. Well, we had a big weekend here in St. Louis, sports-wise and poker-wise. Of course, the Cardinals winning the World Series on Friday night. I had a lot of people email me and say, I guess Dennis wearing that cap last week when he won must have spurred the Cardinals on to their victories.
I take full credit. Absolutely. It was all me.
But we had that amazing story, and we'll talk to Oral about it in a few minutes. We also had the Rams with their unlikely victory over the Saints on Sunday. And in the middle of all that, we also had the big game, which we have been promoting on this show for the last couple of months and which you unfortunately couldn't take part in, but which I did. And we had a great crew of people, both locals here in St. Louis, and about half the players came from out of town. There were people here from Wichita and Bentonville, Arkansas, and Kansas City, and Chicago, and Southern Illinois, all who came to play in this game. We had two full tables of the $15,000 buy-in 25-50 game on Friday and Saturday, and two full tables on Friday and one on Saturday of the backup game, which was 10-20. No limit holder.
Yeah. I mean, obviously I wanted to be there and couldn't be, but I've had a number of people call me, comment on it, comment how full the room was, comment upon how well it was run, comment upon, in fact, several people have been asking me if we're going to be doing that again. So, you know, sounds good to me.
I would have to give them an unqualified yes, we will do it again. I'm not sure when it will be, but we'll talk to some of the participants and see what date works out. You know, one of the hardest things for us to do was to figure out a weekend when there wasn't a major tournament going on here in the Midwest that some of these players might be driving or flying to. And lo and behold, we only have it on the biggest sports night of the year. On the night of Game 7, but we rolled in extra TVs, and the TVs on the wall, of course, all had the game on, and so everybody was happy with that. And I will tell you, we're definitely going to do it again. We'll let you know when that will be, and certainly talk it up on this show. And next time, I'm hoping you're healthy enough to be a participant as well.
Well, I would hope so, too. And I'm quite sure, just by word of mouth and the success that you had there this time, the next one will be even bigger and better. A number of people will probably show up then. I suspect you'll have people, you know, if you had a table of people that came in from out of state, you probably have two tables of people that come in from out of state next time. So bigger and better and more fun. And by the way, a little birdie told me that was walking around the room there that your stack tended to grow rather well on Saturday night at that table.
Yeah, I had a good weekend. Let's just leave it at that.
Well, well done, my friend. Well done.
Thank you.
There was a lot of action going on, and you were probably right in the middle of it. David Tucker is the guy that was there. He was playing one of the smaller games. That's the gentleman with the horn that was out here in 08.
And the truck horn.
Personal friend of mine.
Yeah.
The truck horn. Personal friend of mine for over 35 years. He was there, and he said that it was just a huge buzz in the room. Everybody was enjoying it. There were faces and people that nobody had seen before from out of town there. You guys were sitting around a table with more chips in front of them than he'd ever seen before in St. Louis. Yeah, I think we've got to do this again. It just seemed like it was a very positive thing.
Well, when you have nine guys sitting around a table with the average buy-in, well, minimum buy-in was $15K. Some guys bought in for as much as $25 or $30K. And with rebuys later on, a lot of chips did end up on the table. So, yeah, it was certainly the richest game in St. Louis history and a lot of fun. And thanks to Denise and the whole crew here in the Harrah St. Louis Poker Room for making it go so well, and thanks to Brandon Stephen, who was last year's bubble boy at the World Series of Poker. He is the businessman from Wichita who brought in some of these players with him and some of the guys from Kansas City who he knows as well, and he really takes some of the credit for this, for helping to make it a success. So my thanks to everybody who was involved, and particularly for the guy who kept calling my value bets on the river. But anyway...
Your new best friend.
Anyway, let's talk about the big event that's coming up this weekend, and that, of course, is the November 9. You were in the initial group of nine players who had to sit back for 117 days between the July portion of the World Series of Poker main event and the finale in November. That was hard to believe 3 years ago. So now this is the fourth time around. And the TV coverage, as we've told you, is going to be different. It'll be on Sunday, starting about 3:30 Eastern Time, 2:30 Central Time, on ESPN2. And they will cover it from the 9 all the way down to when they get to 3. And then they will stop at 3 players, and they will regroup and come back on Tuesday night live on ESPN and play from the evening into the late evening, into the night, and who knows how long it's going to go before we finally crown a winner this year. We've talked about how we think that might affect strategy because it'll be near live coverage with whole cards. Ty Stewart explained that on the show last week on a 15-minute delay. Let's talk about predictions for the actual players. I know that you've looked through who's there and who has a shot at this, and do you have a pick for who you think is going to take this down, Dennis?
I actually think it's fairly close among a number of players there. I would hate to have to put a bet down on any one individual player.
And before you make a pick, you know, you can actually go to the Wynn and a couple of other sports books in Las Vegas. The Nevada Gaming Commission has allowed some of these sports books to take prop bets on the November 9. You can bet on who will win, who will be ninth place, in other words, who will be eliminated first this weekend. Will the first flop be more red or black? What will the final winning hand be? Will it be just high card, or will it be a royal flush, or somewhere in between? Will the guy who's the chip leader, Martin Stashko, will he win this? And what will the total number of hands dealt be? Those are some of the prop bets there. So before we talk about some of those, your pick for who you think will win it.
Wow. Well, okay, if you're going to pin me down on this.
I am.
I probably, if I had to pick one person, I probably would pick Matt Giannetti.
Really?
He's not the chip leader by any reason. He has great coaches. He has great experience. He's got a very level head. If I had to pick one person, and he's played well in the last couple of months, by the way, I probably would pick him.
Okay.
Your pick. Pin you down.
Well, I think it's hard to pick against Ben Lamb, who has locked up Player of the Year for the World Series of Poker. He got himself a gold bracelet. He came in second in another event. He came in eighth in another event. He came in 12th in another event before that. 2 years ago, he came in 14th in the main event. Here's a guy who has experience, is not rattled at all by the cameras, the lights, the attention, the stress, the intensity of this. It's not his first time at the dance. I think it's hard to pick against him. I'll be honest with you. If you had picked Ben Lamb, I was not going to pick Matt Giannetti. I was going to pick somebody different. I was going to pick Phil Collins. It's interesting that we narrowed it down to the three Americans, and maybe there's a little homerism going on here. But I actually do think that of the players at the final table, Matt only has half the stack of Martin Stashko, who has $40 million, and then there's Owen O'D with $34 million, and Matt Giannetti with 24.7, and Phil Collins with 23.8, and Ben Lamb with 20.8. And then there's the rest of the field, Bob Bunara and P.S. Hines and Anton Makievsky and Sam Holden. I think those three Americans who are kind of in the middle of the pack are going to be the ones who are going to be driving the action and playing the smartest at the end here. Don't you agree?
I agree with that completely. And it would not surprise me to see two of the three of them come back for the second day of it. I have to admit that. There's a couple of them, I think, that have kind of got their back to the wall. I don't think they have the experience, may not even have the chips. And our chip leader is going to have to prove himself.
Yep.
He may have $40 million in chips, but he's going to have to prove himself. He's definitely not the most experienced or anything at that table. And I have a feeling that he will not be the one driving the action, which could be detrimental to him.
I think that that definitely will be detrimental to him. I think when the younger players, Lamb and Giannetti and Collins and even Owen O'D, get in there, Anton Makievsky, who's eighth in chips with 13.8, this 21-year-old who, if he wanted, would replace Joe Catta, who replaced Peter Eastgate, who replaced Phil Hellmuth as youngest main event winner ever. Makievsky is still in there and could do that. He's going to be very aggressive, particularly because he is still kind of short-stacked here. So
yes.
I think that you're right, that the chip leader, Stashko, is going to have to either step up his game or get stepped on by some of these other guys and see his stack chipped away.
There's such a huge difference as you go up progressively from ninth all the way to first place, and he is the chip leader. And I've seen and watched some of the hands he's played. My guess, have no reason to think so, this is just my guess, is that he will just sit back. He will wait for premium hands. He will try and get it to where they're down to six, five, maybe even four players before he gets very active in it, at which time he's probably going to be one of the smaller stacks. Somebody else will be up around 50 or 60 million. He may have chipped down to 30 million. I don't know. You pick a figure. But I think he will not be the aggressor. He will sit back. He will, you know, pretty much easily finish in the middle of the field. He's not going to be one of the first two or three out.
Yep.
And we'll see what happens. But if he doesn't catch cards there when he does start getting active, he's not going to make it.
Yep, I agree. And by the way, when I talk about Makievsky being short, he's still going to have, about 26 big blinds when this thing starts.
Yeah.
And Sam Holden will have about 24 when it starts. But they're going to have an M of about 10 or 11 because they're going to come in there with antes of 50,000 and blinds at 250,000 and 500,000. And, you know, that's not a lot when you're at a table that is going to be as active as this one is. Although, if we know anything from the past few years, and particularly from your year, things do start out slowly. Talk about that, if you would, from the year that you were in there with Peter Eastgate and Ivan Demidov and Chino Rehm and all the rest of the guys in the 2008 November 9, about how when things started, nobody really wanted to jump right out of the gate.
Well, that's just it. Again, there's such a huge discrepancy as you go up the line from ninth up to first place. You're in center stage. You've got cameras all around. They've been following you for over 100 days now. The guys are standing over there ready to interview. They have prop bets about who's going to be the first person out. Everybody's going to be a little tight, a little cautious. They want to sit back. They don't want to do anything stupid. They want to make sure that they get the cards in good if they can to start with there. With the exception of Anton, I think they're all going to play fairly tight for the first hour or two. You may not see very many flops. It's going to be extremely boring for a while there. Now, Anton might change that up a little bit. He's young, he's aggressive, he's shorter in chips. I'm sure he's got a lot of coaches, including a lot of, quote, 21- and 22-year-old coaches.
Yeah.
Guys with
real poker veterans, yeah.
Yeah, real poker veterans. And he may come in there to take advantage of that. And there is a way to take advantage of that. Nobody wants to be the first person out. Nobody wants to lose a lot of their chips. You may have an end value of 10 or 11 or 15, but you know how quickly that can go. You make a pre-flop raise. You make a continuation bet. You stay in a pot because you flop the nut flush draw, but you don't get it. And it eats away at your chips, and suddenly you look down and you have a 5 or a 6M. Now it's starting to get serious.
Yep.
Now, 11, 12, something like that. You know, you're fairly safe. You don't have to panic. You got a lot of playing you can do. But a couple of hands that you don't win, and all of a sudden, boom, big, big difference.
Yeah. Is there a way for somebody in the middle of the pack, a Phil Collins, a Matt Gianetti, a Ben Lamb, to also exploit that, seeing people who are going to play kind of meekly from the beginning and using that as an opportunity to perhaps three-bet, not getting their whole stack committed, but three-bet and maybe re-steal in certain situations?
There absolutely will be. And the one I would suspect to do that would be Ben Lamb. But again, now he's got almost $21 million. He could do it one time without hurting himself at all. He does it a second time and it doesn't work out, he's going to be one of the short stacks. So he's going to have to be a little careful. But he definitely could step in there and do a little three-betting, get a little aggressive, especially since you suspect that the chip leader is not going to get aggressive. So he's in seat 8. The chip leader is in seat 9 behind him. Depending on where the position, where the button's at, he could have late position on all these other guys, and I definitely could see him doing some re-stealing.
Yep.
That is a type of a game that he could play and play it very successfully.
You want to make a prediction on any of these other prop bets, like who will be the first guy out?
No, actually, that one I don't have an opinion on. There is nobody like, in our table. Kelly Kim was by far the short stack and was an easy pick to be the first one out. He ended up finishing 8th, but you know, it wasn't pretty much of a no-brainer if you're going to try and pick somebody here. Like you said, Sam Holden, he's got over $12 million in chips. He's not desperate by any means. There is no easy pick for the first one out.
Yep.
So if I had to pick one, now this is really going against what I just said a minute ago, I'd probably pick Anton to be the first person out just simply because he's going to get more aggressive. He's going to try and chip up.
Yep, I agree.
He's going to do one of the two things. He's either going to be out or he's going to be in fourth or fifth place fairly quick.
I agree 100%. He would have been my pick here, not because he's a bad player, but because his style is going to be earn or burn.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a good phraseology there. Absolutely.
All right. And what about this? I love this other prop bet. What will the final winning hand be? I assume they mean a whole 5-card hand, not just your 2 whole cards. In many of these cases, a winning hand is just a pair because it sometimes comes down to a race, a pair of sevens versus ace-10 or something like that, right? I mean, we're not going to be looking at somebody getting in with a straight and getting sucked out on by a flush to win the main event. That I don't think that happens.
It very, very seldom. Whenever you have a heads up, it typically comes down to a race. That's why you're trying to grind it out. You're trying to chip it up. You're trying to become where you can lose a race and still have chips in front of you. When I did the NBC heads up, I wanted to get a 2-to-1 advantage so that if I lost that race, I'd still be in it and available.
Yep.
Actually, the one up at Hammond that I just won last week, an hour into the heads up, I was talking to the dealer and I said, you know, it's going to come down to Ace Jack versus some small pair. And he laughed at me and fine. And do you know what it came down to?
What?
Ace Jack versus 7. He looked at me and says, how did you know? And I said, oh, I didn't, but that's just logical. This could be the very same thing. It'll come with 2 Broadway cards against a smaller pair. That's the most logical hand. So it's going to be, you know, King Jack versus 5s or who knows what, something like that. And what it is you hope when you get into the race that you have the most chips so that you can survive it if you lose that race.
Yep. I think so, too. If I were to be putting money on a prop bet there, I would pick a pair to be your final winning hand. Certainly not a royal and probably not high card.
Oh, gosh, no.
But
no, 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 no.
But I'd go with a pair as the winner here. One of the other things.
A small pair.
I'm sorry?
I would even go that far. I'd even say a small pair, 8s or lower.
Okay.
Just to put it even more so. Because you're going to slow play kings, queens, aces, and the other guy's probably not going to have much. You're going to have to get in a race where you each have something in your hand. And the odds on you having pocket jacks and him having an ace jack, probably not as likely.
Right.
As you having an ace jack and he has pocket sevens.
Well, I would say the chances of it being a small pair are about the same as it being a guy who has ace X and catching an ace and winning it that way.
There you go.
So, yep, but either way, just one pair. Another part of this November 9 weekend is going to be the induction, and it won't actually happen until next Tuesday, but I want to mention it now, of two people who have been very friendly to us and to this show over the course of the years. The two new inductees to the Poker Hall of Fame, Barry Greenstein and Linda Johnson. And when we talked about this a few weeks ago and went through the nominees, you and I both agreed that Barry was a lock, and you said very likely the other one would be a woman. And Linda Johnson, the first lady of poker, makes a great choice. I think they both are great choices.
Oh, absolutely. Agree 100%. And just a little note about each of them. Barry, obviously, when you go to charity events, Barry's there. When you go to PPA events and different things like that, Barry's there. He's opened up his checkbook. He's opened up his time. He's tried to help out in all these things that are good for poker players. And he also is a mentor whenever you ask him questions. When I first came on the scene with Stars, I knew that if I asked Barry something, he would try to help me out. The first major event I went to was the EPT over in London. I'm sitting in the VIC, don't know much of anybody, and I sit down at a table, and I look up, and Barry comes over and sits down next to me and says, "Hi, I'm Barry." And it's like, wow.
Yeah.
Nice. Linda Johnson, very same thing. When I was at political rallies for Senator Bennett up in Colorado, who was there joining us? Linda Johnson. When you're doing charity events in different places, whether it's a Jen Harmon or whoever, who's always at those things? Linda Johnson. You can't go wrong with these two. They're just absolutely great picks.
Yep. Linda, the First Lady of Poker, a member of the Women's Poker Hall of Fame, a one-time owner of Card Player magazine. She's got a bracelet. Barry's got several bracelets. They've both been good for poker and have really been great for the image of the game through the years.
Yes.
And I think they're both outstanding picks, and we congratulate both of them. And hopefully we'll have one or the other on after the ceremony to talk about their actual induction. All right, enough about the November 9 weekend. Let's talk a little bit about what happened over this past weekend in St. Louis that had nothing to do with a poker table. Instead, an amazing night on Thursday and an even more amazing night on Friday at Busch Stadium with the St. Louis Cardinals taking down the World Series of Poker. Our guest today was there at the stadium calling the game for ESPN Radio, doing the commentary on the game. I happened to run into him because he came into town a couple days early and came out here to Harris to play some PLO, and we had some fun together last Tuesday night. Oral Hershiser is joining us here at the final table. Hi, Oral. How are you?
Hey, guys. I'm doing great.
Have you got your voice back yet? How do you call Game 6 when it's like that? I mean, how do you keep yourself in the seat?
It was a lot of fun to watch. It was a lot of fun to be part of. When you do color on the radio, I had myself and Bobby Valentine, but our play-by-play guy was Dan Schulman. And Dan, they do most of the talking on radio because you have to describe the action before we can give any commentary. So, he probably does 70% of the talking. So I love radio almost better than TV because I can do all baseball and I don't have to wait for pictures or a camera angle or a replay to describe something. I can just tell people what I see and what I feel.
Oral, in the years that you played in the majors, 17 years in the majors, Cy Young season, MVP in both leagues, a remarkable career, and of course you've done a lot of Sunday night baseball for ESPN Radio. Have you ever gone through a game with as many highs and lows as Game 6 last Thursday night?
Well, there were a lot of times when we thought the game should be over, especially, when the Cardinals are down by two runs, and then they're down by two runs again, and then, David Freese is up there, and you've got to watch because he was the MVP of the NLCS. So when he puts it away with the solo home run, that's a possibility. I actually set up Dan Schulman and said, "Hey, Dan, we're going to lay out right here because this thing could be over in a swing." And the next pitch, he hit it out. This is kind of the same thing I said. Josh Hamilton came up when they took the two-run lead the second time. When the Rangers took the two-run lead, I said, grass doesn't grow under his feet very well. He's probably going to swing at this first pitch, and he swung at the first pitch and hit a home run and put the Cardinals down by two. So it was an absolutely amazing game. I was part of a team that played in a game 7 that went extra innings, the Cleveland Indians in 97, and we lost to the Marlins. And when it was over in extra innings, I was warming up in the bullpen to pitch the next inning, but Edgar Renteria got the base hit that beat us off of Charles Nagy with bases loaded and two out.
Wow. I'm a little jealous. You had a pretty good seat for that game, too. But game 7 there, game 6, you lost. So what's going to be, what could possibly top this year? The story of the Cardinals, how they came from behind, how they were supposed to lose every series and ended up winning it. The come from behind twice, being down to their last swing. I mean, what can possibly top this?
Well, you know, the weird thing is that baseball is considering adding another wild card to each side of the playoffs, and we wouldn't have had any of those races at the end of the season. And the last game of the season that went down to, you know, deciding different playoff races with the Yankees and Tampa Bay and all the different races that were going on. So, yeah, as we expand the playoffs, the possibility of that, we might lose some excitement. We might gain some excitement. You just never know with what rules you create. But it's going to be hard for Cardinal fans to top this year, coming back from, you know, 10.5 down in early September and coming all the way back, beating the Phillies, you know, Roy Halladay and Chris Carpenter battling in a 1-0 shutout that Carpenter, you know, wins, you know, just unbelievable stuff.
What do you think will be the impact of Tony La Russa's announcement yesterday that he's retiring after 33 years as a manager?
Well, I don't know what the long-term impact will be. I think the short-term impact will be a definite cultural shift in, you know, like we had when we lost Bobby Cox the year before here with the Atlanta Braves. I think that there'll be a culture shift. I think it'll be probably very smooth if they pick somebody already on the staff, like Jose Oquendo. It might not be as smooth if they go outside the organization. It'll be interesting to see if that makes Albert want to leave, or if Albert and, you know, Yadier Molina have a say, and maybe who comes on board, and that makes Albert want to come back. Chris Carpenter signed up. Adam Wainwright's going to be healthy. Garcia is coming along. I think the pitching and the bullpen are going to be fantastic. They have a great nucleus to not just make this a one-hit wonder. I think, you know, they would have thought if they would have lost and September wouldn't have turned out the way it did, I think they would have said, you know what, we're getting Wainwright back. We're going to do this move. We hope to re-sign Albert. If we don't, we've got Alan Craig. We've got David Freese on the rise. You know, Yadier's here. Chris is here. So I think they're going to think that they have a very good nucleus. And now they've even got more of a nucleus because they've added to that a world championship.
I agree with you totally on that. One of Albert's things that he wants to play for a contender. There's no way you can say this team's not going to be contending next year, be one of the favorites on it. With Wainwright coming back and with everybody basically signed except for Albert, well, and Jackson, but Jackson we didn't expect to sign. So it's a heck of a team to start out with next year if you could include Albert in the mix.
Well, yeah, I think it's definitely going to be a contender for a time to come. I think that Mozeliak has done a great job getting the minor leagues in order. You're getting homegrown talent that are coming up and making an impact. You've got key players and veteran players that are in the primes of their career. They're not on the downside. So I think, you know, there's a nice 3 to 5 year window depending on who they can sign and what pieces they can add and who can stay healthy. And you had the injury-ridden year this year where you could say, okay, that was bad luck and we had all these major injuries and you still ended up winning a world championship. So, you know, as far as running good, as far as cards are concerned, the Cardinals are running good.
We're talking with Oral Hershiser here on the Final Table Poker Radio Show. I mentioned that when you flew in last Tuesday, when it was an off night, and you ended up with a bonus off night on Wednesday because of the rain out. But on Tuesday night, you came out here to Harrah's, and we had a lot of fun sitting around and playing PLO through most of the night. And you told a story that night. I hope you don't mind me repeating a little bit of it. But people kept asking you for baseball analysis at the poker table. And you said that sometimes when you play in Las Vegas, where you live, you have to be careful not to do that because you've actually seen people leave the table and go place bets at the sports books at the casino based on what you said, which, by the way, I backed you up because I played 10-20 with you at Bellagio a couple of years ago, and I saw guys do that. How often do you see it happen, and how careful do you have to actually be?
I don't usually like to talk baseball about a specific game or a specific something that's happening because the guys do go up, and then I don't want to lose friends, and I don't want to make enemies because of something I've said. I mean, baseball's hard enough. It's a coin flip, even if you could analyze it to the nth degree. And I think there are guys that probably come up with edges over the years, but, you know, there was an edge for a while, I think, with the over-unders with umpires. I heard from, you know, top gamblers here in Vegas that guys would say that, you know, I know certain umpires and or ballparks. But, you know, I think everybody's gotten so good with the computer and so good at setting the lines that for me to sit around and just kind of have fun with the guys and talk, and they ask me an opinion on something, as soon as I can tell it's a specific opinion and they're trying to get a line on it or something, I try to back away from the conversation. I just kind of give them something real general, or, hey, your guess is better than mine, and then they just laugh at me, and I go, well, I don't really want to talk about it.
I hadn't even thought of that. That's awesome. Unbelievable. So they're pumping you for information.
That's not awesome, Dennis. Come on.
You were a friend of Poker Stars up until Black Friday, of course, when everybody who had online deals in America saw that kind of evaporate, Dennis included. So tell us about what you usually play, where you play, what games you usually like.
Well, my wife is learning to play over the last 9 months or so. Dennis knows that because we were together one time when the girls were trying to learn to play. And so I'm playing a lot of 1-2 and a lot of 1-3 no limit right now because she likes me to sit next to her and get in arguments over how she should have played the hand. And then once I've decided that it's better to tell her later or the next day, that's worked out a little better. But so I've got her a poker coach now, so she's learning from a friend of mine that's a very nice guy that's really doing a nice job with her and giving her some 3 or 4 basic rules to play by, and so it's fun to watch her play. And I then play maybe a little bit. If I get bored with that, that's why I've kind of taken up TLO at the low levels, because it's kind of like, okay, I'm playing this over here, and it's at a level that really doesn't get my blood flowing, but I have a lot of fun, and I can sit there with her. And so I've taken up PLO as a next level, because I don't want to then jump from 1-2 and go all the way up to 10-20 or 5-10 or whatever it is, and then have these major swings but not be playing it very much. You know, I've got to get enough reps in there to have it all even out. So I usually then go over just to like 1-2 or 1-3 PLO and kind of play just to kind of get my brain stimulated again. And I'll play, if she's not going to play for some reason, I'll play a little 5-10 now. But I don't like to take the major swings. I do it for majorly just for entertainment. So I feel like my adrenal gland will not go up and down too much if I'm stay below $2,000 to $3,000 of a win or a loss.
Uh-huh.
If I get above that, all of a sudden I get a bad night's sleep or I don't enjoy my dinner. I enjoy my dinner too much. I don't play for that reason. I just play to have fun.
Well, I play with Oral and with his wife, who I believe you've got an anniversary coming up very shortly here too, don't you?
So, yeah, we're going to be married a year here. We've known each other for 7 years, six and a half years, so we're married now for a year. And, it's great. Living here in Vegas with my schedule, we move around a lot. I've got to go do the games. I travel so much. It's a great airport. But then as soon as I get home, there's immediate entertainment if I want it. We just relax and have fun.
I played in several charity events. I got to tell one little story. We were down at the Venetian playing in a charity event, and I was sitting to this nice older gentleman who I didn't know who it was. And he'd lean over to me whenever somebody come to the table, and I'd say, well, that's Brad Garrett from Everybody Loves Raymond. Oh, yeah, okay. And then he leaned over again. He'd say, well, isn't that one of those fighters? And said, yeah, that's Tito. That's a martial arts guy. And we'd be talking that way. And then Oral comes walking over. He looks around the table. He puts his hands flat on the table and says, did you hear? At the final table, they're giving everybody a weekend at the Sheraton. And this guy just busted up laughing, and I had no idea that this was Conrad Hilton sitting next to me.
Wow!
I don't even know if you remember that or not, but I just thought that was a great line, and you just cracked him up.
I knew it, because he's a friend of mine. We had gone, the Bellagio had invited us to a New Year's Eve party, and we sat at his table one year, so we became friends, and he was fast friends with my wife, Dana, who has never met anybody she doesn't like. So, you know, and for her to meet Conrad Hilton, it's like, you know, it was like she grew up in Wyoming. It'd be like meeting the butcher in Wyoming, you know. She's like, no big deal.
Yeah.
To her, she treats everybody the same. So she's treating him like the same and down to earth and laughing and giggling with him, and he's loving it because he's not getting the ring kissed. And so he had a blast with her, and so I knew I could jab a little fun at him.
Well, Oral, we really appreciate you spending some time with us here today. You did a great job on ESPN Radio last week, and it was a pleasure sitting down with you at a poker table again here playing some PLO, and I look forward to seeing you next time I'm out there in Vegas.
I'm sure we're going to be in St. Louis a lot after the World Championship. I'm sure ESPN will be in there 4 or 5 times next year, so I'm sure I will see you.
Great, great.
Take care, Oral.
Oral Hershiser joining us here on the Final Table Poker Radio Show with Dennis Phillips in Las Vegas. I'm Paul Harris in the poker room of Harris St. Louis. We'll come back with Ed Miller, who's going to teach you how to read your opponent's hands when you're playing No Limit Hold'em. This is the Final Table on 590 of the Fan KFNS at KFNS.com, and our podcast available on iTunes and thechipleader.com.
Kids, are you caught up in that old game of shuffling your debt around and hoping you'll get lucky and win the jackpot? Well, it's time to deal. Mortgage rates are low and savings are high. So stop bluffing and call 800-GRANNY-8 or go to granny8.com. You bet our friendly loan officers make it easy, and we don't have an application fee. So call 800-GRANNY-8 and you'll be holding all the aces.
Great mortgage rates, call 800-GRANNY-8.
granny8.com.
This is the Final Table Poker Radio Show with Dennis Phillips in Las Vegas. I'm Paul Harris at Harris St. Louis. We talked about the big game we played here this weekend, and I talk a lot about playing PLO here every Tuesday right after the show. The game actually goes every day. But there's also all sorts of no-limit hold'em going on in the room. Tournaments galore, 1-2 games, 1-2-5 games going on. There's 20-40 limit hold'em that goes on here and 3-6 limit hold'em as well. Bad beat jackpot now up to $93,000. And a month from today, we start the Gateway Poker Classic, which will be 11 days of tournaments, starting with the Jack and Jill event and working our way through a main event and a ladies event and a seniors event and a six-handed event and several PLO events and all sorts of stuff. You can get the details by going to the Harrah's St. Louis Poker Room Facebook page, like the page, and you can find out all the details on what's coming up here at the beginning of December. The full schedule will be there with tournaments as low as $125 buy-in all the way up to the main event of $1,100. And also today being 1/1/1/11 as the date, 10 days from now, you'll add an extra one to that for 11/11/11, and Harrah's has something special that day. You could win up to $11,111 in their Mega Cash giveaway. You come in and you swipe your card at a slot machine or a table game, and you do that between 11:11 a.m. and p.m., and you're in the drawing. They'll have five winners who will each get $1,111 on the 11th minute of each hour. And they'll also have one winner for the grand prize of $11,111. All you got to do is come in on November 11th, and 11 is your new lucky number. Yo, 11 on the 11th of the 11th month of the 11th day here at Harrah's St. Louis. Details, of course, at harrahsstlewis.com. All right, time now for our guest for the day, and that is Ed Miller, who is online at his own website called NotedPokerAuthority.com. We had Ed on about a year ago when he came out with one of his many books, and he's got a new one now, an e-book that's called How to Read Hands at No Limit Hold'em. Hi, Ed. Welcome back to the Final Table.
Hey, how you doing? Good to be back.
Nice to have you back. Last time you and I talked, well, you and Dennis and I talked, we talked about a lot of small stakes strategy. And in this book, you try to teach players how to get an idea of what their opponents have, because that is such a key to how they're going to play their own hands. Start us off, if you would, by some of the key factors to look for when you're sitting at that table considering your opponent.
Well, the main reason I wrote the book, I think, is because a lot of people, you know, when they play No Limit, you know, their hand reading, they think in real black and white terms, you know, so they look at a guy, they got a loose player, they know, you know, and they've got, say, pocket kings, and there's two clubs on the flop, and they bet and get called, and the third club comes on the turn, and immediately they're thinking, he's got to have the flush, you know, that's like where the mind goes. He's loose, he can have any suited hand. You know, he's got to have the flush. And that's not the reality. The reality is, you know, that, yeah, he's going to have the flush, but it's going to be a certain percentage of the time. And the goal of the book, the goal of hand reading, is to try to get a handle on that and come up with an actual realistic kind of percentage chance that your opponent's going to have any given hand.
Well, I like that idea. We've talked beforehand that anything you can do to improve your game, to get it beyond the ABC where, you know, I have a king, there's a king on the flop, therefore I bet type of mentality. If you can put your opponent on a narrow range of hands, it helps your hands so much. It enables you to bluff. It enables you to do a ton of different things out there, including make some of those hero calls that are so hard to do. So how do you start out doing it? You sit down at a table, You've never played these people before. How do you start reading a person? How do you start putting them on a range of hands?
Okay. Well, I mean, you start out, you know, people have two random cards, so that's all you know. and then, you know, and then they'll do something like they'll limp in, you know, and you'll say, okay, well, you still don't know that much about what they have, but then you watch them a few times, you know, a few hands, and they've limped in, you know, twice out of six hands. You know, well, I would say, well, you know, I know they're not playing every hand, but I know they are not raising a lot either. And so from that, I have kind of a list of hands. I got suited aces, suited connectors maybe, pocket pairs, you know, a hand like queen 10 or, you know, and so I start from there. And then you get a flop, and you bet, and they call. And the key point is that people generally have fit the flop in some way if they call. So you can look at all the hands that fit on a flop. You can say you could have top pair, middle pair, bottom pair. You could have a straight draw, flush draw. You could have maybe two over cards. And you can kind of say, okay, well, that's what he's got. And how many of those mix match up with what he played pre-flop? You know, and so forth. Turn comes, same deal. River comes, same deal. And by the time the river's there, often, as you said, you can really narrow down that range because they have so many places to deviate, you know, they would have done with other hands. So now they would have only played, you know, these five hands this particular way.
And I was talking to a guy last week who plays a lot of 1-3 and 2-5 no limit, and I was actually standing behind him while he was playing a hand in a 1-3 game, and they got to a position where another guy had been check calling him on the flop and the turn, and then the river came out, and there were three clubs on the board, and the guy bet out into him, and my friend thought and thought and thought and then called. And the guy, of course, turned over the nut flush. And I asked my friend later on, why did you call in that situation? He says, because I don't want to be bluffed.
Right.
Don't you find a lot, particularly when you're playing at stakes like that, that there isn't really a lot of bluffing, that when people do that, they've got the goods?
Well, that particular line that you just mentioned, where they check call the flop, check call the turn, and then they bet the river, I don't want to say every time because, you know, somebody's always going to mess me up when I say it, but that's not usually a bluff. I mean, if there's a flush on the river, what that usually is someone who's trying to conceal his flush, and then on the river he's like, oh, wait, if I check, he could just check behind. So I bet something. So I find that particular line is not often a bluff. But, you know, it's funny you mention that because I've noticed in Las Vegas, I live in Las Vegas, and I've noticed in Las Vegas, in the last 6 months or so, I would have agreed with you 6 months or so, but now it seems like people are just running ridiculous bluffs on me constantly. It's like almost the other direction. And it is. It's easier for people to go all one way, like I'm almost never going to bluff, or I'm going to just bluff like every third hand, you know, and it's harder for them to get that right mix. But, yeah, people have been bluffing me constantly lately.
I find that a typical player, especially on a lower limit player, very seldom bluffs and doesn't bluff, frankly, as much as he should. He should be able to utilize his position and his chip counts to do a little more bluffing and doesn't. And I've seen other people who make it too mechanical. I actually know of a gentleman who put a little buzzer thing into his foot that every X number of minutes would buzz and remind him that he needed to now bluff. And it was almost a mechanical bluff. I am not
That's
kidding.
Funny.
He actually did this. So, you know, and I think both those extremes are wrong. You bluff when it's appropriate to do it, but it's part of the game. And if you can't lay down to a bluff, if you got to call them, you're in big, big trouble because you're going to be bluffed. And, you know, there are some cases when even if you suspect the bluff, it still makes sense to lay it down. So,
oh, absolutely.
I hope that makes sense.
You know, and you can use hand reading to narrow those places down. You know, you know, as I say, I've been bluffed a lot, and a lot of the ones I've caught, it's because the bluffs didn't make any sense. You know, they were by
Absolutely.
The river, they were representing, you know, only one specific hand, and it's either they have that one hand or they're just full of it, and it turns out they're full of it a lot, but, you know.
I agree with you 100%. We talk about that at the table, that it doesn't add up or it doesn't make sense. Your
right.
bets have to make sense.
Yes.
So
Absolutely.
I'm sorry.
What about the notion, Ed, of using scare cards as part of your play and recognizing what scare cards do to your opponent or do for your opponent?
Right. Well, scare cards are a big one, and a lot of people, again, it's a lot of the bluff-oriented people see any kind of scare card, so the third club comes, right? You know, and they're like, oh, that's a scare card. I'm going to represent it. You know, and so then they, as soon as that club comes, they're like, I'm going to bet the turn and shove the river. And then you have the people who are like the scaredy cats, who every time the scare card comes, they're like, oh, my God, he must have it, you know, and just fold. So people react to scare cards in these really black and white ways. But the reality, obviously, is that scare cards sometimes will improve you and often won't. And so you have to use your hand reading skills. Again, you have to literally kind of count how many hands that scare card, you know, benefits. Like, for instance, scare cards are not created equal either. Like, you know, if the flop comes jack, eight, six, right, with two hearts, and then the river's the deuce of hearts, well, that card only makes the flush. So if he's got a straight draw, he's got 10-9, he's got queen 10, he's got, you know, any of those hands in there, he's got 9-8, he's got, you know, all of those hands that kind of fit in the middle of that board aren't flushes. But if the scare card is like the jack of hearts, so it's queen, what did I say, it was queen 9-7 or something like that, and then the jack of hearts comes, well, now not only did the flush get there, but queen jack is now two pair, you know, king 10 is now a straight. You know, all these hands have now improved beyond just the flush. So you have to be able to look at a scare card and say, well, that helped some hands, or, wow, that helped a lot of hands. And that's a big difference.
I've used that scare card thing, especially in position if you're behind a person. It's so great to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I remember a flop, a guy raised pre-flop, a fairly tight player that you can put him on a narrow range of hands to start with. I had a 6-5 of clubs, so I figured if it could hit, I had position behind him. If he had an overpair, I could get a decent pot out of him. The flop came ace, rag, rag with two clubs out there, so I had a flush draw. He made a continuation bet. I came over the top with another bet. He gets this disgusted look in his face and says, every time, no matter what I do, flops two kings over and folds.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just meekly took the pot, and I'd be danged if I was going to show him my cards.
Right.
But, you know, some people, when you know the type of a person and you know how they play and you put them in a range of hands, I guarantee if he didn't have an ace, he was going to fold there.
Well the interesting thing is people I found, like someone just yesterday, folded ace-king to me in a very similar situation. They put me on a set. And, you know, and so if you're even folding ace-king when you get raised on the flop, then you can just bluff them like crazy. You know what I mean? Like, they have to call with something.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
We're talking with Ed Miller, whose new book is an e-book called How to Read Hands at No Limit, which you can download by going to his website, notedpokerauthority.com. I have a listener named Steve who emailed a hand in and asked if we would analyze this. So I'll just read you the details that Steve provided, and then, Ed, I'll let you react, and then, Dennis, you can chime in as well. This is in a 2-5 cash game. Under the gun raises to $15, and Steve says, I look down at the jack of clubs and the jack of spades in middle position, and I re-raise to $60. The button calls, everybody else, including the original raiser, folds. The flop comes out jack of diamonds, eight of spades, three of diamonds, a perfect flop for me. I quickly bet $60 in an effort to make this look like a standard C-bet. The button calls. The turn is the three of clubs, giving me top full house, jacks full of threes. I now check. The button behind me bets $125. I have about $525 left. He's got me covered. I tank for a full minute before shoving all in. The button audibly moans and groans, fidgets in his chair, and then, without folding, turns over two kings. I'm like a statue. I'm just praying he cry calls. After 2 minutes, he makes a pretty darn good laydown, and I take down an okay pot. What are your thoughts on this? Ed, I'll start with you.
Well, so with the jacks, in a 2-5 game, at least I'm used to, you know, if the guy calling the raise, you know, behind. So he hasn't put any money in the pot, and now he's calling 60. You know, for most players in a 2-5 game, I'm gonna assume that's a pretty strong hand. Maybe not aces, because sometimes people do that with aces too, but aces might re-raise. But, you know, I would put it kings, queens, maybe tens, maybe nines, ace-king, maybe like ace-queen suited. So that's kind of what I'm thinking, that call is going to be a lot. So now flop comes perfect. Obviously, I identified that quickly. And the question is, which of those hands are you going to get money from? Well, you're trying to get money, obviously, from the aces, kings, and queens, and you're going to get relatively little money from ace-king and tens. And so I would play the hand to try to stack those overpair hands, because you're not going to get too much. You're going to get at most one bet out of the other hands, really. That's all you can expect. So because of that, I think I would just play the hand bet, because that gives people the least chance to fold. You know, that's kind of what they expect you to do after you 3-bet is bet. And now he has to sit there with kings and be like, well, is he bluffing? Is he, you know, is that aces? Like, what, you know. And so I would not have check-raised the turn like that. I also would have bet bigger on the flop, because you're trying to get money again from hands like kings and queens. Well, they're going to call 60, but they're going to call 120 too. You know, nobody's going to look at your $120 bet and be like, oh, I've got kings, I'm folding. You know, so I would try to get that money in early, because that lets you make smaller bets later on that he's going to have a harder time folding to. So that's my take on it, is I would not have check-raised. I would have just kept firing, and I would have made the early bets bigger.
Dennis?
One way to play it, there's several different ways, and obviously you're trying to do anything you can do to build the pot up. When he shoved, he said he's basically raising it another $400, which is over what's in the pot there. It's not a bad move, actually, and it's a very good laydown by the other gentleman. I would have tried to milk it. I don't think when the three came that I would have checked. I think I would have put another value bet out there. You're putting pressure on him, because if he does have those kings or those queens or something behind, he needs to make a decision. Can he just continue to just smooth call, or is he going to make a stab at the pot coming back over the top? I think he would have. So, you know, I would have made the bet on the turn when the three came out there. But if I had checked there and then he makes the bet, even a value bet raise, he makes it 125, you know, make it 275. Put him at risk. Tell him you're willing to risk it all and see what he wants to do. Now, there's several different ways to play this. You've got to read your opponent on this one. I don't think I would have checked the turn, though. I think I would have tried to put more money out there into the pot.
Yeah, I kind of agree with both of you, and I want to add one other thing, which is when Steve fake tanks and then shoves.
Oh, yeah.
That is a major strength tell.
Yep.
I mean, unless you're brand new to the table and nobody knows you, anybody who's been sitting with you for more than two hands and has seen you play is going to know that you're probably not doing that. In fact, I've never seen somebody tank, and then shove without a big hand.
Yeah.
It's just not a situation where somebody's bluffing. And what are you hoping that they're going to think about you, that you had a really tough decision and then in the end you decided to put it all in? I think that's just a bad play. I do agree with Ed. I would have bet more when there was already 140 pre-flop to only put in 60 when you smash the flop like that, flopping a set. I think you got to bet 100 or 110 or maybe even 120 there, because you want to build it. And particularly when you're playing a game like this, you want to play for stacks. You want to get all of that guy's chips in the pot, which is why, as Dennis says, you don't check the turn. You bet it. You both said that same thing. I think he had the opportunity for a full double up here, not a scare the guy off on the turn kind of hand.
Yeah, I think
the key point to me is the strength of the guy's range of hands when he calls preflop. I think the reason why I might check a turn in a situation like that would be if I thought my opponent could have a wide range of hands, and I thought he might take a stab at the pot. So if I'm trying to get, you know, say I think he can have, like, 8-10, maybe, right? So, like, just a just a total air ball hand, then I might check the thing. Because if I bet, the attorney's going to fold that. But maybe if I check it, I'm going to get an extra bet out of that hand. But I don't think, I just don't think he's got enough hands like that in his, you know, I think he can assume his opponent is strong enough to be calling value bets, and so I'd be making them, yeah.
Yeah, yep. I agree. All right, Steve, thank you very much for the question. And if you've got one, you can email it to DennisPhillipsPoker@gmail.com, and we'll address it on a future show. And if you want to learn how to read your opponent's hands when you're playing No Limit Hold'em, get Ed Miller's new book, which you can get on his website, NotedPokerAuthority.com. Ed, it's always a pleasure. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Dennis, are you going to be headed for the November 9 this weekend? Will you be watching some of the action in person or on TV?
I will be in person. I will be up there on the stage watching them.
Great. Well,
I'm looking forward to it.
I'll be watching as much of it as I can on ESPN2, and we will regroup next Tuesday and talk about it before the final three play it out next Tuesday night. Until then, I'm Paul Harris. He's Dennis Phillips. This is the Final Table Poker Show on 590 of the Fan, KFNS, and KFNS.com. Podcasts available 24/7 and on demand on iTunes and on thechipleader.com. Thanks for listening.